Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
What if there was a way to level up your energy, get rid of stress, and take more control of your body? Welcome to Quantum Upgrade. This is a new technology that taps into quantum energy to help you feel amazing. Quantum Upgrade has a lot of different products that help protect you from EMF and help activate your body's natural healing abilities. You can expect better sleep, more resilience, less stress, and better blood flow. The cool thing about Quantum Upgrade is that the products are backed by a lot of heavy-duty scientific studies, and there's a new measurable upgrade. You can now use Quantum Upgrade to increase your consciousness levels between 1400 and 2200 on the Hawkins map of consciousness. If you don't know what that means, do some research because it's impressive, it's fun to learn about, and it's something that I've come to understand. Ready to try Quantum Upgrade? Visit quantumupgrade.io/Dave for a 7-day free trial. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit ARRCLED.com.
Today's cool fact of the day is that your stomach produces another complete layer of mucus every 2 weeks, which keeps your stomach from digesting itself, which it turns out is really inconvenient. If you go on a zero-carb diet for very long periods of time, you actually do get to the point where you don't have enough carbohydrate to make mucus and tear secretions adequately, and this can lead to problems with your digestive tract. I figured this out myself when I went on a 2 to 3 month extreme low carb experiment and found it made my eyes dry, my sinuses dry, and reduced my sleep.
What if there was a way to feel younger for longer? Well, there is. Your body needs something called the NAD plus molecule to help you age well. When you're young, your body makes a lot of NAD+, and that helps you make energy, it helps you keep your DNA healthy, absorb nutrients well, and it protects your cells from stress. But once you hit about 30, your NAD+ levels start to drop. The good news is that longevity scientists have found some things that can help, like niacin, niacinamide, and niagen. They help your body make more NAD+, even as you age. All three of these are in an amazing formula called Qualia NAD+. Check out Qualia NAD Plus risk-free for up to 100 days at neurohacker.com/Dave15 to save an extra 15%. That's neurohacker.com/Dave15, Qualia NAD Plus. It's what I use.
Today, we've got an old friend, John Durant. I first met John about 3 years ago in New York City when he was just on a Stephen Colbert show, and he had this awesome paleo versus vegan video, which I featured on the blog, that was truly funny, done in the spirit of comedy about, you know, who can sit on tacks for longer, who can freeze in New York City cold air for longer. And it just made me laugh. So I reached out and said, John, we got to hook up. And we ate at some semi-raw meat kind of place in New York and got to be friends. John's kind of a badass. He studied evolutionary psychology at Harvard, and he just wrote The Paleo Manifesto, which is a pretty cool book, and he's the only guy I know who's a professional caveman, which is at least as cool as being a professional biohacker. He's one of the original leaders of the ancestral health movement that goes a little bit beyond just paleo, and he's an advisor to food bars and health startups, and including one that makes a cricket-based protein bar. This is not cricket the sport. This is cricket, you know, like bugs. So we're going to talk about that for sure. And he's also written for magazines like Men's Health and for Livestrong. And you can find him at huntergatherer.com. John, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Dave.
for those of you watching the show on YouTube instead of just listening in your car, I got to tell you, it looks like I'm speaking to Jesus wearing headphones, like DJ Jesus or something.
Every word I say is truth. I'm infallible. I'm infallible.
Now,
that's the virtue of looking like Jesus.
Is this part of the caveman look, the long curly locks and the carefully trimmed beard and the staff? Okay, you don't have a staff, but...
It's, you know, my mother would like nothing more than for me to get a haircut, shave my beard, and meet a nice girl that has the same value she does. But I told her that for my work, I'd love to get a haircut, but I need to keep it long so that I can resemble a caveman.
John, would this nice girl be celiac by any chance?
Exactly. Right. So, right, at the end of Colbert, if people haven't seen this episode, he asked me what my ideal woman is like. And I say a lactose intolerant celiac woman who eats meat. And I was actually flooded with emails from lactose intolerant celiac women from around the world who were very excited to learn that.
I think that is like such a humorous thing. When I heard that, I almost fell off my chair because it was the way you delivered it was hilarious. But the response from people going, "Oh my God, I want someone who has the same lifestyle I do," must have been overwhelming, because like you feel alone when you're like, "No, I'm not going to eat that crap."
Right, exactly. And so what was really heartwarming about the emails that I received was that ego boost, you know, celiac women emailing me. What was really cool about it was that so many of them had viewed their condition as debilitating, as a disability in some sense. But when you take that longer perspective and say, well, it's not necessarily historically normal to be eating wheat, that you get to redefine normal, and you're like, oh, instead of broken, I actually am eating in a normal way. So that was very cool.
It when you told me that story over drinks, I think at the time you were drinking a grain-based beverage and I was drinking sparkling mineral water, and it was a paleo bacon grain-based beverage, right?
I tend to blot those things from my memory.
But I just remembered that.
Remember, I'm perfect and infallible. Never bent the rules on paleo in every word I say.
Did I just call out the author of the Paleo Manifesto for sampling beer? Oh, I think I did. But that's all right. You know, part of the whole philosophy here is you don't have to be perfect. And, you know, there are some things that are going to knock you out and some things aren't. And, you know, it is what it is. And perfection is a huge stressor. And I don't think one that you'd recommend either.
Yeah, well, I mean, the ethos of hacking and biohacking is to not let perfection get in the way of, you know, of completing something or doing something or being able to actually live it on an ongoing basis. So, yeah, I enjoy being social. I'm a young single guy in New York City. It's hard to be completely alcohol-free or grain-free or gluten-free or anything like that. So it's fine.
We're going to have to send you some activated charcoal. I just launched a new coconut charcoal product that's like the only one like it on the market. I'll send you some. So when you have beer, you can take that with it and you'll have less of the non-paleo effects from your beer.
Cool. Yeah. I have a little bit of activated charcoal in my cabinet. And then I also have been playing around with some white clay.
Yeah. Ben white clay.
Yeah. Which is just sort of interesting because you actually see, have you done any research into geophagy?
Yes.
Right. So you see this clay eating behavior, not just in some human cultures, but in a wide variety of species like birds and other primates. And they use it to help detoxify their diet. It's pretty cool.
Those little balls of clay, you know, that Indians used to carry with them, so when they ate questionable food, they would fix it. It turns out it's harder to get good quality clay in a powder. So you want to get like the pre-hydrated clay, because the powder clays need a certain ratio of water to clay and enough time to be fully hydrated before you eat them. But I've totally gone down that from like zeolites versus bentonites. And
right.
I don't know how deep into that stuff you are, but if so, let's chat about that on the show, because I haven't really talked about that as much as I have charcoal. Charcoal's my favorite, but bentonite's decent.
Yeah, I mean, you will know, you know more about the actual molecular biology and chemistry here than I will. But the what's sort of amazing is they think one of the reasons why it's hard to poison rats is because rats will be nibbling on all these clays, and so even if they eat some of the poison, it gets deactivated.
Interesting. So poison clay is the next big invention for rats.
That's right. Yeah, and you know what? That is a money-making business. Let me tell you, as somebody who lives in New York City and rides the subway, this is $1 billion. It's a multi-billion-dollar idea.
That's great. Rats are like detoxifying themselves with more toxins. Sort of Machiavellian, I think.
When it comes to rats, I'm completely heartless.
Fair enough. They aren't even good eating. I got you there. So one of the reasons I wanted to chat with you again and have you on the show is that here you are, you know, Mr. Paleo, and you've got a chapter on biohacking in your book. Like, are you growing electrodes out of your Cro-Magnon ridges, or what's the deal here?
So people think that my book is going to be about just be about the paleo diet or just about food or just about the Paleolithic. And it's a total head fake. It's not true. We can learn a lot from our ancestors that are older than the Paleolithic, like primates or our primate ancestors. And we can learn about health from more recent ancestors and the information age. So yeah, I've got this chapter on biohacking that is really about some of the insights that we gained about human health when we started to realize that biology is an information technology. So the chapter kicks off with Watson and Crick discovering the helical structure of DNA in 1953. And then over the next half century or so, you see this just sort of like DNA curves around itself. The growth of computers and the growth of understanding biology as an information technology were very much intertwined. All this genomic analysis that we're doing now, completely impossible, clearly, without the rise of computers and information technology. So, you know, this is a whole other era that if you only focus on the Paleolithic, you're completely missing out on. So I'm trying to take a big tent approach in the book and integrate a lot of the principles of biohacking to help customize. Those are the last step, customize how people live and eat and stuff like that.
That is very, I think, very modern and very even futuristic looking, because one of the criticisms that paleo gets is that, okay, well, cavemen didn't really have microscopes and epidemiology and PubMed and Google and like all the things that really anyone, even not a biohacker, paleo nutrition guru right. kind of person, but you know, your grandmother gets symptoms, she goes to Google most likely. Like it's become a part of how we care for and learn about ourselves. And so if you exclude the tweaks based on science, I think you're making a mistake. But if you start from what's a likely chunk of things that our ancestors did, how do we evolve? What's our genes?
Yes.
That's just the elegant approach, right?
Paleo as a hack. Paleo is a hack. It is saying we don't know exactly how everybody ate. We know there was some variation based on geography and time and culture and things like that. But it's a quick and dirty starting point for people to get 80% of the way there. And then you can use personal experimentation and biohacking and things like that to take you the rest of the way and see what works for you. One of the concepts that I really like in the book is this notion of viewing your life and everything in it as your personal habitat.
Amen.
And you know, in a holistic sense. And we now, more than any other species and more than any other time in our species history, have the ability to re-engineer and modify our own habitats to allow us to be healthier. So taking the best of the old with the best of the new. The goal here is not, is not trying to replicate exactly how people lived in the wild. Let's take the best of the old, mix it with terrific technology and culture and everything that civilization has to offer.
Now, you talk about living paleo, but dude, you're in New York City, which is like the least paleo place on the planet, except for like Beijing. So how do you bring those two together? Because you are living paleo in a modern world. And, you know, you're one of the guys who really does it. You swing on monkey bars, you eat raw meat, and you know, you're at least as crazy as I am. So, like, how does it work in a big city?
Well, it's funny. The stereotype of a caveman living in a cave is inaccurate about the Paleolithic, but it's actually fairly accurate for living in New York City. You know, it's a concrete jungle, and a Manhattan apartment is very much like a cave. So it is a cave-like existence. The reality is that people care a lot about their food here. The farmers markets are great. The restaurants are terrific. And folks are very open-minded and willing to hear about people experimenting in their lives. And the other thing is, it's a big city, and when you have a lot of people, it's easier to get a movement off the ground, get that population density. So that's part of the reason why it was good to start here, simply because you could get more minds, like-minded people together. But look, I have a, if I walked my computer into the other room, I have a freezer chest that's currently located in my bedroom. Thank God it's silent. And it has, you know, some organ meats in there and grass-fed beef and salmon and stuff like that, which does make for a few awkward conversations if anybody comes over and is in my bedroom.
Have you ever said, that's my last girlfriend?
Yes.
You have said that?
I've said all
You're a bad sorts, man.
I've said all sorts of things. I've said of all sorts of things. No. I can also play the Jesus angle there too.
Oh, yeah. Lovely. Yeah. The when I think about that the vegans and vegetarians listening to the show are going, "Oh my God, he sleeps with amputated animal parts," you know, but I wouldn't have a problem.
Hey, I'm made of animal parts. So, you know,
it's shocking how that works. And it's also, though, something. Aren't you a little concerned about EMF from the refrigerator coils? Because the refrigerator is one of the biggest sources of EMF.
A little bit, but I right now, given the new apartment that I'm in, I don't have a lot of options.
And you probably can see like 8,000 Wi-Fi access points, so maybe the refrigerator coils just don't matter.
Yeah, New York City is one big EMF.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. Are you earthing yourself?
You know, I'm not totally convinced by earthing. I'm not totally persuaded.
I'm starting to have some concerns about it. I live on an island, like a beautiful island. Where I sit now, there's like 7 old growth cedars sheltering my office, and I have my own pond. And my earthing wire is like on the banks of the pond where it's perfectly moist. I get pretty good earthing here, and it does help with jet lag in other places. But I found out that 70% of electricity in the U.S. goes, the return, the ground, is through the earth. But in Europe and Asia, it's back through a wire. So it turns out there's probably a lot of weird, like, earth EMF stuff going on that isn't natural in North America. And that has raised some legitimate earthing concerns. That said, if you try it and it improves your sleep and your skin tingles for a couple days and all, which is a good sign that you're returning circulation and nervous system function, then do it. It improves my sleep. But I'm wondering if where I am is a part of that.
Yeah, you know, I have no idea. I am totally in favor of experimenting with any of that stuff. And if it does improve what you do, then fabulous. I'm in my third apartment over the last 9 months in New York City. So my own personal habitat is not living up to my own standards and what I'd like to design for myself.
Yeah, it's tough in a big city. I think it requires a good amount of wealth to have an optimal habitat in a highly dense urban environment. It does in every place I've ever been.
Yep.
So what are we supposed to do then? You know, you've written this book, you talk about habitat design in the book, yet you have very little control over your own habitat. And a lot of our listeners are in the same situation. You know, either you're in mom's basement or you're in a small or large condo, but it's got a homeowners association and there's only so much you can do. Like, what are the top three most important habitat design things you can do when you don't own your space?
Well, I mean, people like to talk about diet a lot, but sleep, I mean, you don't get enough sleep and everything falls apart. So, this is basic stuff. I'm sure that you've touched on this in multiple places, but making sure that you don't have lights in your bedroom, that you actually have a shade that blocks out lights, even tiny LEDs on clocks and things like that. Like you, I use the sunglasses at night that block out the blue part of the spectrum, and I've really come to like that. I'm in the middle of a book release, so I'm not going to pretend that I live some optimally healthy lifestyle. Writing a health book is the worst thing I've ever done for my health.
It's hugely stressful. My launch is coming up probably November or maybe January, but yeah, it's brutal. Like it hits you because you don't ever stop, right?
Yeah, don't ever stop. And I do, I don't get enough sleep. I get a little overstimulated in the morning. I need a little, I have a hard cider to wind down at night. And it's, when you're stressed out, your body craves more carbohydrates and stuff like that. So it's definitely a challenge, even for me, somebody who's writing a book about it. But sleep would be the top thing. And then for me, it's food and exercise. Nothing new there. I try to avoid sugar at all costs, pretty much.
Do you up your carbs though? But like, say starch, sweet potatoes, or something on a more stressful day?
Yeah, usually it's more active days if I'm working out, or if I'm a little more stressful, stressed out, maybe some white rice, sweet potatoes, stuff like that.
I find that, if I'm going to travel to Asia, 18 hours in the air and all the just biological stressors that are not exercise related, that having a little bit more carbs helps, because lack of carbs does raise cortisol a little bit, right? So what you want to do is got to have enough cortisol. Maybe I'll just back off today. It seems to work pretty well, but there's a very fine line between, look, I'll have like 6 cups of rice. And I don't think that the line is defined for any group of people. It's different for you. It's different each day. It's different how much sleep you got. But if you militantly go zero carb for long periods of time, in your experience, what happens?
Well, it can lead to, in stressful periods, it can lead to cravings for some of these things. And it's also can just be a little bit socially restrictive. And I try to optimize for sustainability on a long-term basis.
Yeah.
And actually sticking to something that's 85%. Rather than, so if I have an opportunity to add foods in, I take it, as long as, if they don't have big drawbacks. So, low carb is fantastic. If you're trying to repair your metabolism, lose weight, experiment with your performance. If you've got certain neurological issues where keto might be very helpful, I think fasting is a terrific, intermittent fasting is a terrific thing to do. I think those are all great reasons, and cutting away from sugar and sort of doing a sugar detox. But if you feel healthy and you feel good and you're active, you don't have to be militant about only having X number of carbs a day.
Yeah. And I actually think it can become an eating disorder. Like, oh my God, I measured everything and I had more than 26 grams of carbs. I'm a bad person. That kind of thinking isn't really useful or even healthy.
Well, let me turn that question on you, because in the biohacking community, there is a lot of obsessive measurement. And when does that start to become a problem?
I think anytime you spend your time and energy measuring something, when you're not actively working on fixing or changing or improving it, if you can gather data at no cost to you, gather it, you might need it someday. Like, that's a zero sum game. But when you start obsessively measuring stuff and you have no idea why you're doing it, you got to think about, like, are you just a pack rat, but you didn't have any more space? Like those, what's that TV show about pack rats? I don't remember its name. I don't watch that much TV. Yeah. There's these people who like hoarders. That's what it's called.
Hoarders.
And they stack, magazines and trash like up to the ceilings. You can do this in quantified self. And I know people who are like that. And it's like your house is clean, but your hard drive is dirty. And so how much of your life did you spend gathering data that didn't help you? Because that's wasted time and effort. Look at specifically, all right, I want to fix my sleep. So you gather your sleep quality data, you gather all of the variables that you think might be there, and then especially focusing on the ones that you're trying to change. And you change a few variables, it improves, it doesn't improve, then you tweak. But I agree with you there. There's a risk there, just like, you know, oh my God, I ate exactly the wrong thing. On the flip side, there's some things like gluten. Don't eat it. Like, it causes long-term damage from, like, single intakes. And I just did a podcast interview yesterday with Dr. Tom O'Brien from the Gluten-Free Summit. And we talked about that, you know, memory B cells and how it affects you neurologically and biologically. Sort of like, don't eat cyanide. You don't need that either. You know, that everything in moderation doesn't seem to apply there.
Right. Well, and what annoys me a little bit, you know, there's been a little bit of a backlash against the rise of gluten-free,
yeah,
where it's like, are we all celiacs? I don't think so. But what I wish people had a little perspective. The starting point just a few years ago was that whole grains were this nectar of the gods and there were no downsides to eating them, and they should be the foundation of our diet. I mean, give me a break. I mean, the existing attitude on grains and wheat was totally, totally skewed just in one direction and did not have any notion of a cost-benefit analysis to these foods. So this is a much needed correction.
Yeah. I think that we agree on that one pretty strongly. But you mentioned something a minute ago about fasting, and you and I both practice fasting, and I'm a huge fan of consuming fat during a fast, you know, the Bulletproof Coffee or the Bulletproof Fast. But you did a 3-day fast at a Trappist monastery. Okay, I did mine like in a cave in the desert by myself for 4 days. So I beat you by 24 hours, buddy. But like, okay, what did you learn at the Trappist monastery versus just doing a fast in your cave in New York?
Well, it was very helpful to, as I'm sure you realize, to go into a completely different habitat where you didn't have electronics buzzing, you didn't have people interrupting you, you didn't have the demands of work and things like that. That's very important to make sure it goes well. The ascetic tradition among monks is a very fascinating tradition. I mean, you look at a group of people called the Desert Fathers and Mothers in Egypt, back in the early parts of Christianity, and they were doing what you did. They would go to a cave in Egypt and fast and be barefoot. There's a group of monks called the Discalced Orders, which means shoeless or barefoot. So the ascetic tradition was a really cool thing to explore while I was fasting. So I went to this Trappist monastery called Gethsemane. It's in Kentucky. It's about an hour south of Louisville. And it's the sort of mother house of Trappist monasteries in North America. They had maybe about 80 or so monks there. A lot of people think that Trappist monks take a vow of silence. They don't actually, they aren't completely silent all the time, but talking is discouraged. So adding the silent aspect to the fast was a really interesting experience. You realize how naturally chatty humans are and how difficult it can be to go 24 hours without saying anything.
It's really funny. Some of the non-Western cultures are much more comfortable with silence. So it's okay to walk in silence, and like they'll look at you like, why do you white people talk so much? Like, can't you just shut up? It took me a while to get comfortable with silence as well. I did a 10-day Buddhist thing in Nepal.
Oh, did you do it? Cool. I've heard of
it. It wasn't Vipassana where you're silent for all the time. We were silent for like 22 hours a day and like talked at lunch while eating vegetarian cuisine that made you fart while meditating. That part I didn't agree with. I want the bacon monastery, but that's a different
You need to start your own branch of Buddhism.
Bacon Buddhism. No, yeah. I've offended every major world religion in one podcast. I'm sorry, everyone. Like, I respect
you. No, I know. Well, you know, I'm an equal opportunity offender. That's how I
do. Yeah, me too.
as I'm sure you've discovered, halfway into day two and then into day three, it felt like a mild high. I mean, I sort of just wanted to sit in the sunshine. My energy level declined. My body was adaptively being like, okay, expend less energy. My temperature went down. I got a little bit cold, mildly cold. I threw on a sweatshirt. my head was clear, but I didn't really want to focus on anything work related or anything demanding. Even reading felt a little bit strenuous. And I went for a run on the first day of my fast, and on the second and third day, I did not want to move very much. I some people think that, okay, you start fasting, your body's like, you're hungry, you better go hunt. And maybe I felt that on the first day. On day two and three, my body was just like, okay, you're not getting food, turn down caloric expenditure in the form of heat and movement.
I felt the same way. I went for a hike on my first 1 to 2 days, and the last 2 days it was like, this cave is really like comfortable, even though it's dusty and rocky.
Right. My skin felt amazing, just amazing. I sort of wanted to touch my face on days two and three because it just felt so clean and smooth. I've found that fasting definitely helps my complexion. And it was funny. We had a short conversation with the abbot, the head of the monastery, and I was talking about my experience fasting, and they were fabulous people, very kind. But he goes, yes, there are some psychological effects that we've noticed, which is why I sometimes don't encourage people to be fasting for too long. They were a little bit thrown by it. It definitely felt like a mild high on day two or three from what I've read.
So the normal person who has never tried fasting, and right now I'm saying abnormal people try fasting just because less than half of people have tried fasting. There's like millions of people who've tried it. Probably if you haven't tried it, you would imagine enormous suffering. Because like, I'm going to be cold, I'm going to be hungry, I'm going to want to kill people, I'm going to pass out, I'm going to lose control of my body. Like these are visceral things that most people think about. And certainly if you get your health and nutrition under control first,
right,
fasting is not like that. You do get a little cold, but you get a mental clarity that's amazing.
Like, did you know that I was fasting during my Colbert interview?
No.
Yes. So, I had terrible sleep the night before because I was just nervous.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Maybe got 4 hours of sleep. And I need six. I know you can do all sorts of amazing things. I need six at the least. But I knew that if I ate even a few meals that day, I would be tired as all hell. I had a little bit of pastrami in the morning at about 8 a.m. And then I had a little bit of green tea right before I went on at about 7:30 at night. But other than that, had nothing for about 24 hours.
You didn't look like someone who was losing control physically, falling asleep in your chair, shivering uncontrollably. You looked dialed in.
I did. I felt great. I felt great. I feel focused during what I typically do is 18 to 24 hour fast. And I have terrific mental clarity. I know that if I eat too early in the morning, and it depends a little bit, it depends on what you're eating. But if I eat too early in the morning, particularly carbohydrate or fruit, my brain function just gets way worse.
Yeah, those things are kryptonite in the morning, especially fruit. That's one of the worst things you could have for breakfast in terms of mental clarity.
It's funny how if you optimize, if you optimize for mental clarity, you seem to optimize for pretty much everything else.
Yeah, like the fat loss is effortless. Look, I have muscles, and I forgot I didn't lift any weights for a year. It just happens automatically.
Right.
I did this thing. I was in Asia for 12 days, Korea and various parts of China, and I was on this crazy schedule where I was in like 7 1-hour meetings every day where I was presenting about biohacking to like hedge fund managers and large investment bankers. So literally land and then start talking and don't stop talking all day, every day. And these people were looking at me funny because like I made bulletproof coffee in my room. So all I had in the morning was, and I was rationing my butter. I had 3 sticks of Kerrygold to last me 11 days. And like, there's not a lot of good fat in China. So I'm like, yeah, little butter and I use my Brain Octane, which is like an extract even of MCT oil. But
right,
I had that and coffee, made my hotel room in the morning. And then we'd go to this really fancy lunches and I'd be like, no thanks.
Yeah.
or I would have like 2 tablespoons of rice, and I would put like I would just pour butter and MCT on them, and it would be like something to soak up the fat. And
right.
It was like they just looked at me funny. I'm like, guys, sorry. If you want me to continue nailing every meeting over and over for 11 days straight, you're just gonna have to let me eat weird stuff.
Right.
I'm sorry, like the Peking duck, which I dearly love. Like, I'm not touching that stuff because I will be tired and I'm not gonna be focused when I'm, you know, talking and sharing knowledge. So,
well, and it's tough over there because people can get offended if, you know, if meals are a pretty important status thing over there. So
I guess I was wrong when I said, ew, gross, right? Was that?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. It's funny because like I'm willing to eat bugs and things like that. You know, so I'm not offended at the food, but it's like, hey, if that food's going to knock me out, I'm, you know, I don't want to step on your manners, but it's also rude to fall asleep in your plate. So like
Take your pick. You can either have great presentations or I can sit here and eat.
Yeah. And people hearing this might think we're both crazy, but if you try this kind of thing, you find that your ability to like, to be in it, to bring it over and over and over is higher when you're not putting blood in your stomach towards digestive processes, when you've stored enough energy in your body, not necessarily even as fat, when you can use the fat in your body as energy, when you can use the muscle and liver glycogen that comes from eating carbs, but doesn't last very long.
Right.
When you're an equal opportunity energy user, like life changes. And you've experienced that as well, very obviously from what you're saying.
Right. Yeah. Couldn't agree more.
Let's talk bugs, because I just talked about eating like fried scorpions in China. I'm like, what were they fried in? Like, I'm the only guy who would ask that about the fried scorpion. But so you have cricket-based bars, crickets.
Yeah. The company is called Exo. And it started by two awesome recent Brown grads, Gabby and Greg. And they started... there was a rash of articles over the last year and a half about insects potentially being a healthy, sustainable, ethical source of protein, not just in here, but around the world. But it didn't seem like there was a lot of action on it. There was a lot of talk, no action. So they started to order a bunch of crickets to the dorm or the house that they were living in college, live crickets. And their poor roommates. And so then they started to figure out ways to prepare them that people would actually eat them. You know, most people, their experience, if they've had, most Westerners or Americans, if their experience with bugs, maybe like a chocolate-covered grasshopper. It's kind of like a novelty gag gift or something like that.
Tequila, the worm, man.
Yeah, there you go, tequila. Right. Got to have the whole bottle first, though. But what they really wanted to do, which I think is smart, is start to normalize the consumption of insects. So they started with a protein bar, and to be honest, the cricket flour that they use, quote flour that they use, the powder, is odorless and tasteless. So people bite into the bar thinking that it's going to have some odd taste, but it actually tastes like coconut oil and dates and cacao and all other delicious things that that people love. It's interesting how disgust plays such a strong role in what people are willing to eat or not. You know, and what you're brought up with and how you're disgust. I mean, the disgust reflex, a lot of vegans and vegetarians are not at the forefront of eating insects, even though they've talked about it, because they get they just get grossed out at anything that resembles an animal product or moves or is tastes like flesh or anything like that. Just grossed out. They can't stomach it, even if it's more ethical and a practical solution to a lot of problems.
It's a tough dilemma there. All right, when you take these things that are relatively high in omega-3 fats.
Right.
And have, I don't actually know the amino acid profile, but
it's amazing. I don't know it off the top of my head, but it's like covers the spectrum.
Impressive. You imagine you're eating a whole bug. So, you know, those feed fish and they feed birds and like they're a reasonable protein, I'm guessing. I know there's a lot of chitin, which isn't very absorbable, but you get the stuff, but then you grind it into flour. So you're oxidizing the delicate omega-3 fats. You're denaturing the protein. Like, how inflammatory is cricket as a protein, like the dipeptides and tripeptides? Do you have any inflammation info on it yet?
I don't yet. And it hasn't been studied very much because people just aren't talking about it. What I think is good is these protein bars are just the first step. It's just the initial product to get people acclimated to the idea that they are eating insects. And then from there, you can develop a supply chain and start to come up with more products that can optimize for health and stuff like that.
There is a really good argument for tofurkey made of crickets, not tofu. There's an environmental, there's a soil argument, there's a health argument, like there's a moral and ethical argument, like all of those go into play. So I would eat, a pressed cricket loaf long before I would eat a pressed tofu loaf.
Yeah, agreed.
Which may surprise a lot of people, but there's a lot to be said there. I'm also wondering, what do the crickets eat? Are they grass fed?
So they're no, they're not grass fed. The and the crickets that are currently grown, the way the supply chain is set up right now, is they are fed grain. But what's really cool about it is you start to feed them other foods, and they start to take on a different nutritional profile and a different taste. You can if you feed hot peppers or something like that to them, then the crickets actually start to have like a hot taste to them.
Nice.
It's pretty cool.
I've had termites that tasted vaguely like pine nuts. They're in a forest that had more evergreen. I totally could see how they would just take up the most active parts of it, like the capsaicin. That's interesting.
Right. And then they're working with a Michelin starred chef who is starting to design, different recipes and things like that, more for the gourmet restaurant crowd, not just protein bars and stuff like that. So it's very cool. They had an amazing Kickstarter where they were going for about 20K and they ended up with about 55 or 60K. And one of the things I feel very passionately about this, we have to support. One of the problems with veganism and vegetarianism is that it's essentially a boycott against a product, right? It's people saying, I will not buy meat or animal products. Period. But as any entrepreneur knows, and you have a lot of entrepreneurs that listen to you, if you want to start up an alternative system, an alternative food system that's healthier and more ethical and more humane, then you have to support the entrepreneurs that are doing it right. Right? Because if you withhold through a boycott $1 million from Cargill, they don't even notice it. It's a rounding error. It makes no impact on their decisions, and they grow industrially grown soybeans, and they turn around and they sell you Boca Burgers. However, $1 million to a bunch of food startups and permaculture farms and this EXO, the insect company, makes a huge difference. Your first dollar of revenue, breaking even, first dollar profit, this is a big deal. So in terms of having an impact on, quote, starting up an alternative food system, it makes much more of an impact to contribute dollars to people that are doing it right than to take away dollars from the big players that are doing it wrong.
That is such a wonderful philosophy. One of the things that I'm blatantly trying to do with the Bulletproof Executive is to stimulate demand for the good stuff. Because when you do it, even the big monster companies... I'm not anti-capitalist by any measure. I have an MBA from Wharton, which means I'm evil, actually. But at least from some perspectives. But the point here is you can make the big guys do it by torturing them and beating them with sticks and protesting outside their headquarters, or you can simply allocate your dollars to the small guys who do it right. And when that happens, your quality of life will go up so much that eventually when enough people see it, they'll also allocate their dollars that way. And suddenly the small guys are big and the big guys are annoyed about it and they have to fix the crap they're doing. And like that's right. How we drive change without, explosions and protests and throwing rocks and things like that. There's a place for that. And certainly it's worked in a lot of the Middle East. But I would prefer that change happen because people said, I'm actually not willing at any price to buy industrial chicken because it's not food. It's not food for my dogs. It's not food for my kids. It's not food for me. And when we do that, they have to change the way they do it.
Right. And it's a peaceful way of making change. If you actually want an old example of you get what you pay for, look at Jewish kosher law. I mean, the relatively small Jewish community has been paying a small premium for kosher slaughter and inspection for millennia. And guess what? They've been getting kosher slaughter and inspection for millennia, right?
Yeah. So same with halal, right?
Same with halal.
So we know that these rules work. That's brilliant, actually, John, that you brought that up, because all we need is, the biohacker equivalent or paleo or grass-fed, whatever you want to call it. The name isn't that important, but I want to be able to go into a store and be like, I don't want to have to ask, what did the animal eat? And the butcher go, food? And you're like, no. Was it grass? Yeah, they ate some grass, right. I'm pretty sure. I want to know. And so if everyone else wants to know too, and you sit down in your restaurant and you're like, oh my God, I'm not ordering your beef. Like, you want me to spend $70 on a steak and you can't tell me what the animal ate? Like, and it ate GMOs for $70? Like, screw you, buddy. Bring me a grass-fed steak. I'll wait. Like, if you said that to the top chef, and I've said this in a polite, friendly, joking way, they listen. Like, the Epic Roast House in San Francisco, right on the water, they've always had grass-fed corn-finished beef. And now they have two grass-finished steaks on the menu. And, like, I don't know if I did it. I certainly talked to them a couple times about it, maybe Twittered once or twice. But hey, hats off to you guys, right? Like, you did it. Thank you. So everyone listening to this, especially New York, you have even more power. Like, get the restaurants to do the things like that and then share it on social media so they see they got the impact. And it doesn't take that much work.
Well, I'm actually putting together right now a primal guide to New York City where we're showcasing a lot of the restaurants that are doing it right.
Oh, lovely.
And we're going to put some criteria on there to other restaurants and locations. If you want to be on here, here are the types of things we're looking for. And not, what the animal eats, but also nose to tail stuff, what oil you cook in. I've become an advisor to a restaurant called Hugh Kitchen in New York, which is near Union Square. And it's fantastic. They have this amazing sign outside that says, "We do not cook in canola oil."
Oh my God. I want to tell me their name again. This will be in our show notes.
Yeah. Hugh Kitchen, H-U, short for human kitchen. And their tagline is "Getting back to human." And they only cook in either coconut oil or olive oil at low heat.
Very respectable. And if every restaurant got that message, we would transform some parts of human health just from doing that, because the number of people with this, 40-1 omega-6 to omega-3 ratio in their blood, and they walk around hurting all the time, tired, foggy, not knowing why. Like, I'm sorry, what your tempura was fried in changes the quality of your thinking.
Yeah, in some ways, I feel like vegetable oils are much more insidious than some grains.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Because I know it's on the menu if the grains are there. I know that they're going to, I know that the bread is in the bread basket. I know what it is. But all these mystery sauces and soups, and I have no idea what's in there. And what have they cooked them in? Has this actually been steamed, or was it fried in canola oil that's already been used three times to cook other garbage?
It's pretty much like you can assume if it's at a normal restaurant, it's garbage oils. Even if it's a pretty nice looking, expensive normal restaurant, and it's a sauce that came from Sysco Foods, which means it was 74% MSG, so it's not labeled that way. And from there, who knows? And it's not like the chef is evil. The chef is just saying people like it. Like, they order more of it. It tastes delicious. I tasted it myself. It was wonderful. So I'm meeting the market demand, and we just have to change the market demand.
Hey, I have an idea for you. Let me float an idea for you. You're familiar with how McDonald's was pressured back in the early 90s to switch from cooking in beef tallow to partially hydrogenated vegetable oils, right? And then people realized how awful trans fats were and things like that. We should start some sort of petition or movement to get McDonald's to start cooking in real animal fat
again. Yeah, we'd have to be like return to... return to the past, to appeal to the idea that they've done it before. Two questions there. Number one, would anyone who's listening to the show actually go to McDonald's even if they cooked in non-grass-fed animal fat?
I don't know. You know what? If they were willing to make that change, I would go and buy something there. I would.
Yeah. Like a water?
Look, there are... No, I will sacrifice my health. I will be a sacrifice. I will sacrifice myself for others.
What does your shirt say? The human weapon? You just lean
human
forward.
Human weapon.
I love it. Okay, cool.
Yeah, there's a guy, Tony Blauer, who does self-defense courses. He's a big cross.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
Sorry, if you're listening on the radio, that was a bit of a non sequitur. I'm looking at John. You can see us on YouTube, and he's wearing this cool shirt. It just says hashtag human weapon. Like, that's kind of cool. All right, we're getting close to the end of the show, and there's a question that I ask everyone who's ever been on the show. Given everything you know, not just paleo, primal, et cetera, what are the top three most important recommendations you have for people to be more bulletproof, to kick more ass in all domains of life? Like the biggest performance upgrades you know.
Getting off of sugar and switching to a fat-based metabolism would have to be near the top of the list. When it comes to movement, I think what people need is so many people, the problem is not knowing what they need, that they need to move or exercise in some way sometimes, but doing something on a, finding something that motivates them on an ongoing basis so that they actually do it. So for me, it would be getting off of sugar and processed foods and to a fat-based metabolism, finding some sort of movement that you find fun and that you will do on an ongoing basis, and getting a lot, you know, getting enough sleep. Those don't sound like very, I wish I had some sort of like crazy advice that's more like outlandish or something like that, but I think it's more fundamental.
Yeah, I believe it. I really do. These are wonderful pieces of advice. So I always learn something from asking this of guests on the show.
See, when it comes down to it, a lot of people look at paleo and sometimes think that it's this like dramatically weird, different way of eating. But in some ways, it boils down to Michael Pollan's advice, but being more anti-seed, anti-grain, legume, and more pro-meat. And not looking down on that so much.
Can we say pro healthy meat? Because
pro healthy meat,
pro industrial meat doesn't work. Like,
yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. Agreed. I'm with you.
Figured you were. I just want our listeners to get that message, because if you start being pro meat and you're like, oh, I just ate, you know, the crap chicken, like you won't get the effects, John, that you write about in your book. You won't feel bulletproof. Nothing will happen other than you might grow breasts.
Yeah, the chicken breast, not good. Not good. Not good.
All right. Your book is awesome and well worth reading. I'll hold it up so people can see it. It's called The Paleo Manifesto, just launched. Please go out and buy this book and support the work that John is doing. John, give us your Twitter handle, your URL, and all of this will be in the show notes. We'll link to you when we put this up live. But how do we find you?
On Twitter, I'm John Durant, JohnDurant. My website is huntergatherer.com, and the book is The Paleo Manifesto, and it's everywhere where books are sold. And even if you aren't into paleo, you are going to find something that you like in this book. I guarantee it.
Yeah, it's pretty broad ranging. It's not yet another paleo book. Is that an acronym? YAPB? Maybe
you just coined one.
We need a hashtag on Twitter.
Yeah. But,
I don't want to denigrate anyone's paleo books. There's so much amazing research, and they're not all the same. But if you are already converted, you will find that there's maybe a little bit of overlap in a lot of the paleo books. And you, because you are one of the early paleo guys, you've actually had a chance to look at that. And I found your book had some refreshing stuff in there I haven't seen elsewhere. So totally one I recommend.
Cool. Thank you. This was a ton of fun. It was great being on the show.
Awesome. Next time I'm in New York, we'll hook up again.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Thanks, John.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem, or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider.
This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.